Welcome to the Brown County Hour.
Coming to you from the legendary hills of Brown,
where the plum purple haze,
the one nature herself drapes over the hills and hollers,
inspires local characters, artists, and nature lovers.
It's as though the hills themselves conspire to create a beauty and culture in the heart of Indiana.
Sit for a spell and hear the music.
Tall tales.
True stories.
And current goings on.
Brought to you by folks who still know how to sit by a fire in winter.
And swim buck naked in summer.
Welcome to episode 157 of the Brown County Hour. This is Sarah Lytle.
And Dave Seastrom, along with the rest of the crew. Our musical guest this month is Henry Lee Summer, and we'll share our interview with him in a few musical selections from his warm-up preceding his show at the Brown County Playhouse.
We also have essays from Jim Eagleman, Lucy Schultz, and Dave Seastrom. In keeping with the season, Deb Bowden has an April Fool's story, Dadgum Quail.
In our first segment, we'll feature Hoosier rocker Henry Lee Summer, who said he'd perform at the Brown County Playhouse every week if they'd let him. On March 1st, Henry Lee returned to the Nashville venue for his fourth Playhouse gig, and the crowd must love him as much as he loves playing there because it was a sold-out show. The Brown County Hour gives you an exclusive backstage pass with Henry Lee Summer recorded just hours before that show. We'll listen to that interview and one of his tunes. We also have Jim Eagleman, who goes batty on a new segment of Nature Ramblings about a local creature often misunderstood but vital to our local ecology.
This is Chad Carruthers, and along with Chuck Wills.
Hey, Chad.
For the Brown County Hour on WFHB, and we are here backstage at the Brown County Playhouse with Henry Lee Summer.
And Chuck, and Todd, and Jack.
The whole crew's here. We are here at a sold-out show. Congratulations on a sold-out show.
Not bad for old man.
Now, this isn't your first rodeo at the Brown County Playhouse.
This is, seriously, I know everybody, you always say good things. This is the best concert room, you know, this size. I played everywhere.
Really?
It's the best run. Bob McCutcheon is, because he's got all that experience up in the internet. Everything's professional. Great sound system. Great people that work here. And the sound of the room is excellent. There's not a bad seat in the house. Everybody I talk to after the show, they talk about, you know, I can hear, see everything. It's just...
They ought to hire you to do promos for the Brown County Playhouse. You're a fan.
Well, I am, because there's so many. I played places where it looks like it's really nice, but you get up there and start to play, the sound is just horrendous. And if you don't have professional people you're working with, it's not like I think I'm special or anything, but they can make your life miserable. I mean, you come in there thinking you're going to do something, and they'll start telling you stuff, and you go, what?
This is your fourth time. Here at the Playhouse.
I would play here every week if they let me.
Now, outside of the Playhouse, why Brown County? Why do you come to Brown County?
I don't play anywhere right now. Since I got off the road, I don't play anywhere that I can't drive home after the show. Uh-huh. So if it's more than, say, hour and a half, 2 hours, I'm not booking.
Well, where are you based out of? You're from the Terre Haute area, aren't you?
Brazil, Indiana. Yeah. Okay. Small town, 15 miles east of Terre Haute.
And you live in Indy now?
Yeah, I live on the west side, right by the racetrack.
So your rule is you don't play anywhere that you can't drive home that same night?
Well, I was on the road for over 25 years, so, you know, that's a lot. You know, if I don't have to sleep in a hotel bed, I'm fine. You know, I don't like hotels.
Yeah.
After a while, they all become just really bad.
Well, you have been on the road for a long time. I remember when I first heard your record, I was 14 years old. I was visiting my cool uncle in Fort Wayne. And you had just, your major label debut had just came out.
That's where I got signed with Fort Wayne, by the way.
Really?
Yeah.
Talk about that.
The guy that signed me was TJ, oh, come on. He's a great guy. He's an older fellow. And we'd been passed on them three times. We'd been passed by every record company. That's how it always works. Because nobody wants to take a chance, because if they sign you and you flop, it's on them. So anyway, we came in there, and it packed house. And the guy went out and asked people, what do you think about this guy? You know, he didn't tell them who he was or anything. He'd ask them, why are you here? And then I guess the enthusiasm from the crowd had a lot to do with it. Plus, probably the thing that got him here was we sold 50,000 copies of Time for Big Fun on our own. For somebody to do that on their own, that's a big, back then, it's a big deal.
Yeah.
So that's how we got signed.
You got signed in Fort Wayne?
Fort Wayne, yes. I came into the club, I don't know if it was Gentry's or somewhere like that, but yeah, Fort Wayne.
See, I had a cool uncle. You know, I hope everyone has a cool uncle. You know, my parents were kind of straight. But I had a cool uncle, you know, the guy who drives the convertible and, you know, lets you have a sip of his beer.
Talks like this, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And he played your album for me. He said, oh, you got to check this guy out. He's a Hoosier rocker.
Well, you tell him I said, thank you. Who's it?
So Hoosier, so speaking of that Hoosier rock thing, you know, when I think of what it means to be like a Hoosier rocker, you know, that's a pretty short list of names that comes up.
Well, the Kings, Mellencamp, you know. I've always been a big... I saw him play like one of the very first Terrell Indiana's, when his first tour he played, and he played Her So Good at the beginning and the last song, you know. So I thought it was way cool.
Well, one of the biggest shows you ever did, you did a show in Bloomington
yeah.
in 92 with Mellencamp.
And I also did the Fairgrounds with him,
there too. Were 40,000 people. Were those the biggest shows you ever did?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, right up there with Mellencamp, if I was to make a short list of, like, you know, the Hoosier rockers, I would have to put Henry Lee Summers on that list.
Well, there's some, like, David Roth is from in there, but he didn't make it out of here, so we don't... In my book, he doesn't get to count. So.
Well, and I'm talking, too, about, like, the Hoosier sound, you know? Like, Midwest rock sound. Would you talk about that
people ask, what is it? I say it's a cross, this is my opinion, don't get mad. It's a cross between the Beatles, CCR, Creedence Clearwater Revival, and Bob Seger. To me, in my mind, that's kind of like the best explains how it is. Because there's that, we're all, you know, sitting in front of the TV in 1964 on a Sunday night on the Ed Sullivan, 73 million people at the time watched that show. And every guy, that's what I'm going to do. Everybody, next day at school, everybody, John Paul, George Ringo, everybody's writing it down, drawing pictures. And I just like trying to ask somebody, where can I get those boots at, man? Where can I get the boots at? Oh, I was hooked. I wanted to join the Beatles. I didn't realize it didn't work that way. But, yeah.
We are backstage at the Brown County Playhouse with Hoosier rocker Henry Lee Summer.
Henry, I've got to ask you about the band that you are with tonight. That band is incredible.
I mean, yes,
you've
I
got Chris Pyle on drums.
Yeah.
You've got Mark Moran on guitar. You've got three backup singers.
I've never had a band better. I've had some really good bands when I was touring. One band, like, there was only one guy, I think, was from the United States. There's like guys from Australia, from Great Britain and stuff. The record company was paying, so I could afford to get people like that. There's not a band I ever had that was any better than this band right here. I don't want to insult anybody, but I'll just say there's nobody better around here. These guys could play with anybody. I mean, if Mellencamp needed them to play easily at that level, I'm blessed to have them to play with. Hey, Bob. That's the guy I was talking about. That's Bob McCutcheon. He's professional. He runs his place because he has experience.
Bob's the draw, huh?
Seriously, he is.
Bob is the master.
We are backstage at the Brown County Playhouse with Henry Lee Summer. Sold out show tonight. Your fourth appearance here at the Brown County.
Well, that has a lot to do with Bob. Bob has lots of connections. You want something done, just call him Bob. He'll take care of it.
Anytime, Henry.
Well, he's got his sellout hat on tonight. Yep. So he told us a little story during soundcheck that he's got this special hat, right? That he only wears when the show sells out. That's how you know. And he's wearing that hat right now. So what's next for you? Where do you go from here?
Well, I have to show. I'm going home. Let's see. My next thing I'm going to put out is I'm going to put out a compilation of everything I've done, like all seven records. And a lot of groups will do like a box set, but do something like that. You know, have videos and stuff and appearances on different shows. Something professional like that. And, you know, have a swinging picture of me on the front, you know.
Now, the show's sold out, which means there's a whole lot of people who are not going to be able to see you tonight. How do they follow you? Where do they find out more information?
I'm old enough, I don't know anything about the internet, and I know everybody nowadays goes on the internet, and I know there's web pages.
You've got a website. You got henryleesummer.com, and I looked on that page, and for current stuff, it says go to the Facebook page.
Did it say I was playing here tonight?
On the Facebook page.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was surprised to find out people don't buy CDs anymore. I didn't know that. They told me they'd string or something. I said, why are they going fishing? What's the problem?
Right. We've been speaking with Henry Lee Summer here backstage at the Brown County Playhouse. For the Brown County Hour, I'm Chad Carruthers.
I'm Chuck Wills.
And I'm Henry Lee Summer.
We had a bat in the house the other day. It crawled on our living room floor with its wings, using them like legs. The genus Chiroptera means hand wing. Their forelimbs are adapted as wings, so when I saw the attempted movement of legs trying to propel it across the floor with its outstretched wings, I thought, okay, not very usable as front legs, but certainly superior as wings. Bats are far more agile in flight than birds. You may have seen this on summer nights as they twist and dive for flying insects. The occurrence of bats in houses seems to be a common thing, and I hear from my friends all levels of concern. The most common that bats are carriers or vectors for rabies. Some alarmists say not to even breathe the air in which we find a bat, like the one I found in my living room. But the fear of contacting rabies must come from the bat actually biting its captor. And we all know not to handle them. Due to their physiology, bats are one type of animal that can act as a natural reservoir for many pathogens. Since bats are mobile, social, and long-lived, they can spread disease among themselves, and when humans interact with them, these traits become potentially dangerous. Knowing this, I carefully scooped up the bat with a piece of flat cardboard, and I released it to the outside. After washing hands and disposing of the cardboard, it made me think where the point of entry might be. Now, with my seasonal invasions of mice in the winter, setting traps with peanut butter and monitoring them daily, I must now inspect closely all doors and window jambs, garage and crawl space doors, and any possible entry point. I know any tiny opening in an attic vent or ridge cap vent, cracked foundation, and ductwork can create a place for a bat to wiggle through, and being warm-blooded, bats will seek out warmer environments as cold weather is with us. But my fear of these flying mammals is soon outweighed by the direct benefits provided us. I have to remember they occur all over the world, so what we may think isn't all that helpful can be to other cultures. Bat dung or guano is mined from caves and used as fertilizer. Bats consume insect pests like mosquitoes and suppress the transmission of mosquito-borne diseases. With their flights just at dusk each summer evening, they are reducing the need for pesticides. And bats are sometimes numerous to serve as tourist attractions. And yes, they're even used as food across Asia and the Pacific Islands. The Indiana bat is now identified as a federally and state endangered species, and it's of special concern to the many biologists I worked with the Indiana DNR. Training sessions how to manage certain habitats where this bat may live include when to cut timber, conduct prescribed fire, and how to properly secure their hibernacula, or the caves where they overwinter. You may have seen some of these cave entry points on certain DNR properties now closed with heavy-duty steel frames. Open enough for the bats to fly in and out, disturbance is minimized, so entry by the public is not possible. If bats that live in these protected caves within a year-round temperature at 55 degrees, if they're disturbed in winter during what's called their torpid state and they fly, there's no food source. They become weakened and die. Closing these previously opened to the public caves helps conserve these rare animals. And I can practice my own kind of bat conservation by leaving dead trees stand, particularly with trees with loosely hanging bark, and also living shagbark hickory. These act as tiny roost sites in warm weather. Bats crawl up underneath these loose pieces of bark and rest there till nighttime. The fascinating habit of echolocation enables bats to swoop in and fly close to prey, even though the flights of both are haphazard. The type of webbing on its wing, it's like a baseball mitt, and even the skin attached to both rear legs, it allows capture there. We watch them fly from behind a security light and observe them bending their neck and head to eat mid-flight. The insect was caught in the wing webbing or between the legs, and then a small handheld speaker we had picked up their soft squeaks, and we heard the tiny blips as they flew close and honed in on their prey. The squeaking sound is loud enough, just like the one you might hear in your attic. The most common bats in Indiana are the eastern pipistrel, the red, the gray, and hoary, and the big brown and little brown bat. Of the 13 species in our state, most find our limestone caves in southern Indiana provide year-round habitat, with enough food, water, and shelter. While resident populations exist as insectivores, they are also migrators and can fly seasonally to traditional roost, feeding, and birthing sites. Much maligned and considered a nuisance, bats get a bad rap. We need to change that and think of them as a healthy part of the Indiana ecosystem. They frequent our yards and properties when there is sufficient food in the form of insects. While they look for food, they are also pollinating. We can encourage insects and bats by planting native plants that belong here. The benefits of these natural systems is severalfold. Native plants attract native animals, birds, bats, and insects. These are the base ingredients, I can call them that, and that are needed to keep Indiana and Brown County wild, healthy, and natural. And as a friend said the other day, bats, they're the only flying mammals, and they're just too cool to walk. Jim Eagleman for Nature Ramblings, the Brown County Hour. Talk with you next time.
I'm Vivian Wolf with PVH, which is Peaceful Valley Heritage. The Model A Fords are coming to town. Jeremiah Reichman will present a program on 100 years of history in Brown County, the time period before the Model A, certainly during the time the Model A came to be, and the difference that it made to Brown County, bringing people in. He's put together a nice PowerPoint. So that will be on the 8th at 6:30 at the Brown County Community Foundation, the lower level in the Howard Hughes meeting room. If anybody would like to come, it's an open meeting. So I think it's really going to be good and interesting. I've seen a preview of it and I'm excited about it. So that will be on the 8th at 6:30 at the Brown County Community Foundation, the lower level in the Howard Hughes meeting room. I'm Vivian Wolf. That's the news with Peaceful Valley Heritage Preservation Society.
Now we pause for station identification.
You are listening to the Brown County Hour on Volunteer Powered Community Radio, WFHB, at 100.7 in Brown County, 91.3 and 98.1 in Bloomington, 106.3 at Ellettsville, and online at wfhb.org.
Support for WFHB comes from Our Brown County, a magazine for locals and visitors featuring art, entertainment, and county characters since 1995. Printed 6 times a year and available online. More information at rbrowncounty.com. On Sunday, May 4th, Our Brown County celebrates its 30th anniversary with a party at the Seasons Lodge. That's the 30th anniversary party for Our Brown County from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. Sunday, May 4th at the Seasons Lodge.
Segment 2 begins with some fond memories from our correspondent, Lucy Schultz, about Ski World, in a piece that also features a couple guys who used to work there. Deb Bowden dons the persona Great Aunt Hula Bell for her April Fool's story, Dadgum Quail. And we close with a Henry Lee Summer tune.
Ski World by Lucy Schultz, WFHB. Going to Ski World as a kid really did shape who I am as a person. I have solid memories of the music jamming from the lift speakers, hot chocolate in the lodge, and all of the fun that I had with my friends and family. I first started thinking about writing this essay when I interviewed Brown County Junior High student Aesop Berkmeyer in episode 150. We learned that Aesop's great-grandfather was part of World War II's 10th Mountain Division. After fighting the war, they returned to the U.S. to popularize skiing across America. They built 62 ski areas around the country, including Aspen and Vail, which brings us to our little town of Nashville. For those of you that don't remember, Nashville, Indiana was a bustling ski town in the winters. In 1978, construction began on our very first ski resort, Long Mountain. Then the Nashville Alps opened in 1979 and was owned by a group of Indianapolis investors. Then Mr. Frisbee bought it and named it Ski World. In 1986, Mr. Risky bought it and his daughter ran it later. In 1980, my father's electrical company started servicing ski lifts at Ski World. My dad said about 6 years into working, they couldn't pay us, so he began the trade of a century. My whole family got free lessons, season's passes, and free skis when we grew out of the old ski equipment from the pro shop. We were working class kids skiing with rich kids. I started skiing when I was 5 and a half, and my brother Nick was 4 years old. Now that's the time to learn how to ski. An underdeveloped mind, fresh muscles, and a mindset of have no fear. Systematically tackling the bunny hill, then to gentle bend, onto nosedive, and then to the scary outer limits. Steve Cordell tells us some of his favorite memories of working as a ski instructor at Ski World.
Teaching my daughter, Callie, when she was not quite 4, and I taught her to ski on all the hills at Ski World except for the one in the back that went off of the top of Gentle Bend. I think it was called Petty's Plunge. And I remember her skiing up to the edge of that and looking down and saying, "No, Dad, no." She was going to be 4 in March, and she was skiing all those hills in January and February. And with these little skis about, this won't transmit over the radio, but not very long. That's my fondest memory of Ski World right there. One time, there were some group classes we were doing, and there was a group of kids that were from some sort of drug and alcohol rehab house. And there was a young girl who was maybe 16, 17 years old. And I taught her to ski. And at the end, she said, "Look at me, I can ski and I'm a druggie." And she was like so proud of herself. And I'm almost getting tears now thinking, I wonder if that really did something to her self-esteem, straightened herself up and made something of herself.
Thank you for teaching skiing for all those years, Steve. Jeremy Brown tells us a story about how dangerous it was to ski at Ski World. One year at Winterfest,
a kid named Brad and I raced each other to get just to that one obstacle you could kind of catch some air off of. And he was just a little bit faster than me, so I packed off, and he hit it, and well, a jump never moved, you know, when it was just snow, but this moved, and yeah, I broke my legs on the teeter-totter. You know, I was out. The ski patrol was right there. They could see I was pretty injured. They loaded me on the sled and took me to the ski patrol shack. My dad came and he said, I don't need an ambulance. Just load him in my station wagon. And I had cardboard splints on my legs. They slide me into the back of the station wagon and he drives me to Nashville and met Tim Allward. And they took me up the elevator and he had some atomic age x-ray machine. And my legs were definitely in bad shape from the knee, you know, from the knee down. The x-rays confirmed it, you know, they're broken. So dad said, all right, let's load them back up. So he took me home and I spent the night on the living room floor until the next morning. And there was a surgeon that agreed to set my legs at Bartholomew County Hospital. The next morning, my dad drove me to the hospital in the station wagon. And yeah, they set the legs, and I was in a two cast and wheelchair bound for a month and a half to 2 months of school. It's a funny story, but I know dad was real anxious about the cost, you know, because in the 80s, we didn't have health insurance and he could have been on the hook for, you know, a big ambulance ride and emergency room visit. And it just seemed normal too at the time.
Good old Dr. Allward. Jeremy, that's a funny story, but it sounds painful. At Winterfest one year, my brother Abe's team of four locals won the obstacle course. Another year, Mr. Risky paid Billy Kidd, the most decorated Olympic slalom skier in America, to come to our little Winterfest. He taught my friend Jonah how to tuck to gain speed when he was just 6 years old. Tony White worked as a lift attendant for 3 years in his teens. Tony, tell us about some of your funny experiences.
As a youth, I actually snuck up there. After hours, I knew the combination, so we just went up the tower. There was a fire tower on top of the hill, if you remember. And we went up top of the fire tower, hung out, let's say that. Took some of those, rode down in total darkness.
That's great.
Yeah, it was fun. So there was these two young girls. I'm 18, and I'm teaching them how to ski, snowplow, and bunny hill. I said, snowplow. And I said, I think you girls are ready to go to Gentle Bend, which is a really gentle, you know, it's an easy little ski down. And they said, no, I don't think so. I said, I'll get you on the lift, and I'll meet you at the bottom. I'll buy you a hot chocolate. So I'm waiting at the bottom, and I'm like, nothing. I've waited for an hour. I thought, what's going on? Then I seen the emergency crews go up with a toboggan and bring her down. And she broke her leg. I asked him, he said, yeah, her leg's broke. So I went out, bought two hot chocolates and went out to the barn, which what they called it, the barn, and took them their hot chocolates and apologized. And one time a girl got stabbed in the hindquarters with a pole. And they didn't want to remove it, you know, because you'd never know what it was in. Obviously, it's just muscle. So they cut it off and they were going to cut her pants off. And she'd, no way, these are guest jeans. There's no way you're cutting my jeans off. But you know, back then, guest jeans, that was it, right?
Yeah.
So they cut it off and she went to the hospital on her belly. They hauled her out of there and they were going to take it out in the hospital.
For my senior prom, we rented out Ski World's arcade and concrete slide called the Ridge Runner that Tony mentioned. This was put in as a last ditch effort to make money. It was fun riding down those sleds, but many of us got bruises and abrasions. The Ridge Runner was shut down quickly after by two personal injury lawsuits. Sadly, in 2002, Ski World closed their doors after a short stint with go-karts. Our town wasn't meant to always be a ski town. We don't get enough snow, and it's hard to make snow and keep it, so therein lies our problem. However, Ski World would have had a killer 2024-25 season. What I really liked about skiing was the freedom on the slopes. Even if you were skiing with your friends, you were still alone and working on your own skills at the end of the day. Most of us locals have their own good and bad stories about Ski World, mostly good. Thank you to my guests, Jeremy Brown, Tony White, and Steve Cordell. Thank you to Ski World for the weekend midnight madness, friendships I built, the exercise I got, the packed parking lots, the restaurants with lines in the middle of the winter. But most of all, Ski World equaled fun, and that was the main reason we all went. This is Lucy Schultz on Brown County Hour, WFHB. I leave you with one last memory by Steve Cordell.
About this time of year, I remember teaching night classes, and they started at 6, and how nice it was standing out there on the top of the hill. And the day, it's about six now, and the days are getting longer, and the sun was setting off in the west, and it was such a beautiful sight up there at the top of the hill, Ski World in February. I mean, it's kind of bittersweet because we knew that ski season was about over. The days were getting longer and spring wasn't too far away.
Be a part of the audience for a live taping of the Brown County Hour on Saturday, May 3rd at the Brown County Inn from 5 to 7 p.m. to support WFHB's Spring Fun Drive. This special event will feature musical performances from Sherri-Ann Wettstein and Friends, plus interviews, essays, and skits from our friends at the Brown County Hour. This special episode will air Sunday, May 4th at 9 a.m. So join us on Saturday, May the 3rd, 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Brown County Inn as we record this special Fun Drive event.
Great Aunt Hulabelle here. My niece did this to me when she was 10, and I paid the price for years. She lived in a neighborhood that had more boys than girls. She had a hot temper, but she was her daddy's princess. She hung out with the guys rather than play with dolls, saws, hammers, hatchets were more her style, as well as collecting odd pets, you know, like rats, squirrels, praying mantises, possums. She took her tools with her wherever she went, said they always came in handy. She ran the two boys her age, Sean and Joe. They brought along Jerry, a new kid who was 2 years older and full of stuffing. Her daddy knew the kids liked to bike in the state park, so while he barely knew Jerry, he trusted the others. Sean and Joe warned Jerry about her temper. He just snickered and decided to take her snipe hunting to bring her down a peg. You know the drill. Jerry said he needed her help. She was to hold the sack while he herded the birds toward her. Now that gal knew snipes don't hang around the woods. They like marshes and mud. Said they were aiming for the overlook. She figured that boy didn't know his birds. Thought he was really hunting quail, so she packed seeds. Jerry planned on running away for an hour or two and leaving her holding the bag. Thought she'd sit there getting eaten up by chiggers and the boys could have a good laugh. Didn't go that way. Jerry took off, but Sean and Joe circled back. Damn if she didn't catch three pheasants in that short time. One was a golden pheasant, full-grown male. Never saw one around here, but heard tell there was one loose in the state park and the DNR were trying to catch it. Well, guess what? They didn't, but she did. Seeing how animals just cutting up to her for no reason, I can tell. She got that male and two ring-necked females all caught up in her sack. Guess the three were a family, 'cause none tried to escape. In fact, she sat on the ground playing with them and shaking out the seeds for them to eat. Well, when Jerry got back, all swaggering like some rooster, he got a surprise. She wasn't sporting chiggers, and he hadn't knocked her down a peg. But he saw an opportunity. That boy decided he was taking her birds home to barbecue. Said she could supply the tater salad and homemade pie for the four of them. And guess you don't know, my tomboy niece ain't about to cook nothing more than a fried bologna sandwich, nor is she going to let Jerry eat her new pets. She flung Jerry's bike down that hill. He called her a couple names she didn't appreciate, so she punched him in the solar plexus. He went down but didn't pass out, thanks to Joe slowing down her fist. Jerry staggered up just as she pulled a hammer out of her belt. He climbed up a young tree close by and started to mock her. That did it. She grabbed her saw and started cutting down that tree to get at him. Took Sean and Joe both to stop her. They tossed the tools into the grass just as a DNR officer drove by and pulled over when he thought my niece was being molested. The three played innocent and blamed Jerry. Said they were protecting the birds which he'd caught to cook. Jerry squawked he was being murdered. The officer didn't believe him. He ordered the boy out of that tree and took the golden pheasant with him. Jerry slid down the hill to get his bike and took off like a rabid coyote was after him. When my niece and her two buddies showed up at my house, she was toting those two ring-necked females. Begged me to keep them with my chickens for a few days, said they were traumatized. I let the pheasants go after a week, but they left eggs behind. I thought my rooster got frisky, and I guess he did later on, but that golden bird nailed him first. Now I've got me some strange-looking birds picking in my yard. Ring-necked golden pheasants, gold chickens with real long red tails. You name it, I got it. I just call them all chicken pheasants. Did I tell you this all happened on April Fool's Day? Well, I guess no one's gonna believe me, but those eggs are just as colorful as my birds, and they taste mighty good.
We pause for station identification.
You are listening to the Brown County Hour on volunteer-powered community radio, WFHB, at 100.7 in Brown County, 91.3 and 98.1 in Bloomington, 106.3 at Ellettsville, and online at wfhb.org.
Support for WFHB comes from the Brown County Inn, located just off the main street of Nashville, Indiana, at 51 State Road 46 East. Brown County Inn is also a restaurant, bar, and gathering place for visitors and locals alike. More information at browncountyinn.com.
Our final segment begins with an interview with some filmmakers. In the new full-length film, Never Not Yours, 30-something siblings drive to their family cabin to visit their parents, who then unexpectedly announce their divorce, and chaos ensues. Guess where the movie was filmed? Yep, right here in Brown County. Chuck Wills interviews directors Stephen Klein and John Niss. The film will be shown at the Brown County Playhouse on Mother's Day, and John and Stephen will be there. Dave Seastrom shares a story of times past, and we'll close the show with another Henry Lee Summer tune.
This is Chuck Wills for the Brown County Hour on WFHB, and we are talking about the movies. Our guests are filmmakers who have done something very special. They have filmed a movie right here in Brown County. It's called Never Not Yours, and I'd like to introduce the co-writers, co-directors, and co-producers, John Klein and Steve Niss.
Chuck, thanks for having us.
Yeah, welcome to the show, guys. We're really thrilled to hear about a movie made right here in Brown County. As I mentioned, it's called Never Not Yours. You guys are the creative force behind putting this together. So why don't you tell us how this happened?
The cast were the first five people that we brought into the fold with us. We knew we had a family of five that we had written. We never ran auditions. Four of the five were actors that we had worked with before, one of whom, Timmy Hart Barron, who plays the younger brother James in the film, read the script, knew we needed a cabin, goes, guys, you know, my parents own a cabin in Nashville, Indiana, that might be a great fit. And we didn't know what to say. We were like, okay, yeah, great. Send us pictures. And, you know, why don't we go spend a weekend at the cabin, just the three of us, and see how it feels. And so that was kind of the first time. I think it was the first time that I had ever been to Brown County. John, it might have been the first time you had ever been there as well. And I think there was an instant connection to the place and to the cabin and to the town, to the people that we met just in that short little weekend, where after that point, there was no other possible location where that film could take place. And we were still mid writing the script. So we were able to adjust the story to be written directly for Brown County.
That's exciting. So it sounds like the location sort of became a character in the movie.
Very much. We talk about that frequently. I think the cabin itself has its own kind of life to it. And no matter what angle you kind of approach the cabin from visually, you got beautiful views. There were so many things just in the vicinity of this cabin that made the film just feel like a much bigger thing as well. And then just being in Nashville and the hospitality of all the people who helped us make the movie and get us permits to make different parts of the movie. Everything about the town, you know, we put a title card at the very end of the movie that's just basically a special thanks to Nashville because it was such an instrumental part of the film existing at all, but having the sort of like vibe that it does.
After watching one of the clips, it's very visually appealing. And as you watch these characters go through the challenges of being in these crossroads of life, it was neat to see them in places that we recognize.
I think John and I are very Midwestern minded in kind of our upbringing, but also in the stories that we like to tell, in the people that we like to work with. And just ran into that in Nashville, where I think the two of us like to think anybody we collaborate with, oh, you need a favor here, I'll shoot that commercial for you, or I'll work on your film, I'll help you out. Oh, you can't pay me right now? Don't worry about it. Pay me later. We did pay our crew, just to be clear. But in Nashville, like, we would talk to a neighbor and they would say, oh, you need access to Hard Truth distillery branding here. Let me get you in touch with the owner of the company and we'll set up a meeting. And all of a sudden the next day we're having lunch and getting the branding for bottles that appear in the background. It was very clear that it's one of those places where everybody kind of knows everyone. And if you show that you have a reason to be there and you want to be there and you value being there, that they're going to help you succeed.
I appreciate that you saying that the film's a very visually appealing movie, you know, that like there's an element of, we didn't have to work that hard. Like, it's such a beautiful area.
Yeah.
Really, like you put the camera, you put it in any direction and you're looking at just incredible greenery and these sort of rolling hills, and the town has such a small town America feel to it that you just can't help but sort of absorb that and take it in. And so when you watch the, hopefully when people watch the film, they feel that warmth and that generosity, and you feel like that comes across in the film somehow. Because I think at the end of the day, the movie itself and the story of this family it's interesting to say that, you know, it's a story about divorce and about this family sort of fracturing and breaking apart, but it's also about these characters sort of becoming the better versions of themselves and realizing that for this family, this is actually something that's going to bring them closer together in a strange way. So the movie, I think, for us in that Midwestern way, feels kind of like a warm hug a little bit, something that like people come to see and feel like afterwards they want to call their families and tell them how much they love them and appreciate them. And hopefully that's, you know, the vibe that we're capturing.
Where has this film been shown so far?
So we're at the tail end of our film festival run right now. We have screened in St. Louis. Recently, we screened in Montana, in Polson. It's been at a lot of these kind of very small, close-knit community festivals. But like, what's so exciting about us being able to screen this film in Brown County at the Brown County Playhouse is that it feels like a homecoming for us, getting to finally show it to an audience that will see places and things in the film and feel it, I think, on a different level. Everywhere we've screened the film, it's been really successful, and we've had really wonderful conversations with people afterwards. But I don't know, there's something special about coming home.
Oh, we think so too. And let's talk a little about that. Your film is going to be shown at the Brown County Playhouse on Mother's Day, Sunday, May 11th. And it looks like there's going to be two showings that day at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. Who's going to be there with the film? Are you guys going to be there?
We will definitely be there. We think there's a fun little significance to screening it on Mother's Day, given that you're going to watch the film and you really are going to want to talk to your family about it after. And if you can attend the film with your family, even better. As John says, it is a warm hug of a movie. What says warm hug better than Mother's Day? Nothing.
I see you guys have a clearly honed strategy for this. So on Mother's Day, you'll be able to see the film at the Brown County Playhouse. You can get more information about those showings at browncountyplayhouse.org, also the Brown County Playhouse Facebook page. And I know folks are going to want to learn more about your movie. You have a Facebook page for that. It's Facebook, Never Not Yours Film.
And if you're curious, go see the trailer. The trailer is available on YouTube, and it's available on all of those social sites as well.
Sure. And we're going to post a link to the trailer on our Brown County Hour website as well, so that people can go check that out. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about your film. It's called Never Not Yours. You'll be able to see it on Mother's Day, May 11th at the Brown County Playhouse. We've been speaking with the writers, directors, producers of the film, John Klein and Steve Ness. Guys, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Chuck.
Thank you, Chuck.
Hey, I'm Raider here with a message. Miss the February Health Fair? Mark your calendars for April 26th, 10 to 2 p.m., Brown County YMCA, free health screenings and social services information. Brown County YMCA, 10 to 2 p.m., April 26th.
My dear friends, Dale and Jean Bond, met in grade school and fell in love sometime in the 1930s. They grew up in a Brown County that was far different from the one that we know now. It was in the height of the Depression, and the times were tough for the folks who chose to stay in the county. The roads were a muddy mess at certain times of the year. Horses were still used for transportation and farm work, the forests were slowly recovering, and the wildlife was just starting to make a comeback. Dale told me about a rite of passage that he and other Brown County kids participated in, poaching deer from Camp Atterbury. The camp had been mothballed shortly after World War I, and it was one of the locations where white-tailed deer from Michigan were released. By 1900, white-tailed deer were extinct in Indiana, and Dale grew up hearing hunting stories from his elders. When they heard about deer in Atterbury, they couldn't resist the temptation to bring some venison home for the table. Dale joined the Army at the beginning of World War II, and he fought in the Battle of the Bulge as an artillery gunner. When he returned home, he and Jean were married, and they started a family. They bought a little farm outside of Bean Blossom, and to make ends meet, they both drove a school bus and worked on the farm. Dale was also an auctioneer and a real estate appraiser. Dale's dad was the local undertaker, Earl Bond. At that time, Earl operated the only ambulance service in Brown County that utilized his hearse. Dale needed a way to move his tomato crop to the Indianapolis farmers market, and his dad Earl made him a deal. If Dale was willing to answer the ambulance runs at night, he could use the hearse to haul his tomatoes to the market on the weekends. One night, in the early 50s, Dale got the call to transport a lady who had been involved in a fatal accident on State Highway 45, just inside of the county line. When he arrived, he was confronted with a grisly scene where a lady had left the road and driven into a tree where she was killed instantly. When the police finished their work, Dale was cleared to load the body onto a gurney and transport this unfortunate lady to Bloomington Hospital. He carefully strapped her to the gurney, loaded it into the ambulance, and locked the gurney down to the vehicle. By this time, it was the middle of the night, and Dale was in the very curvy section of Highway 45. While he was driving in one of those tight curves, the latch on the gurney came undone. The gurney slammed in the back doors of the ambulance, and they sprung open. Gurney, lady, and all launched out of the back door, rolled down the highway, and careened into a very steep ravine that was right next to the road. Dale pulled over to the side of the road, stopped the ambulance, and got out. Dale was a physically fit young man in those days and climbed down to the bottom of the ravine to fetch the gurney and the lady. There was no way to move both of them at once. So, first, he brought the gurney up and placed it back in the ambulance. Then he went back down for the lady. On her way down to the bottom of the ravine, she had slammed into several trees, and the poor deceased woman was battered beyond recognition. Dale shouldered the lady and slowly made his way back up to the highway. All of this took a couple of hours, and by the time the unfortunate victim was strapped into the gurney again, Dale was exhausted and covered in her blood. After making sure the latch was properly closed on the gurney, Dale made his way to the old Bloomington Hospital to deliver the crash victim. When he arrived, there was paperwork to fill out and arrangements to be made. When an orderly arrived to transfer the body from Dale's gurney to theirs, he took a long look at Dale and the very battered and bloody lady. Turning to Dale, the orderly said, "Wow, really must have been some crash. I've never seen a car accident victim in such bad shape before." Nodding his head, Dale said, "You don't know the half of it, buddy." And he signed the papers and drove home to take a shower. The next day, Dale and Jean cleaned the Hearst ambulance and returned it to Earl, who was never told what happened. Times are different now, but every time I'm on that curvy section of 45, I remember this story, and I think of what it must have been like that night. This is Dave Seastrom. See you next time. In return. Thanks for tuning in to episode 157 of the Brown County Hour. This show was recorded in our studio at the History Center here in downtown Nashville and brought to you the first Sunday of every month at 9 a.m. and the second Wednesday at 6 p.m. and anytime online. Be sure to look for us on your favorite streaming services.
The Brown County Hour is brought to you by a diverse group of folks who believe, now more than ever, the world is for everyone.
This show was produced by
Chuck Wills,
Pam Rader,
Rick Fettig,
Vera Grubbs,
Lucy Schultz,
Sarah Lytle,
Chad Carruthers,
and Dave Seastrom. We would also like to thank Slats Klug for our theme music. You have been listening to the Brown County Hour,
coming to you from deep in the woods of Brown County, Indiana.
Celebrating the arts, culture, and nature that make this such a unique community.
Visit us online at browncountyhour.com.
The Brown County Hour is a production of WFHB.
Volunteer-powered, listener-supported community radio for South Central Indiana.
Take me back to my home, Brown County home.